BBC World Service. And now on Discovery, an architectural journey for the ears, as Trevor Cox explores the science of sound and the spaces we inhabit, from classrooms to concert halls.
We're walking into Symphony Hall. I came in here for the first time when I was a student in 1963, and it's a wonderful place to hear music, especially the kind of music that is played here. I don't think there's any place in this country that compares to it, really, for the sound of an orchestra in the main repertory for orchestra.
Music critic Richard Darr has a deep affection for Boston Symphony Hall. Built in 1900, it's still acknowledged as one of the top three spaces in the world to hear classical music. The hall is also a special place for an acoustic engineer like myself. It's our version of Mecca, the first place where modern acoustic science was successfully applied to a concert hall. In auditoria, there's usually a close relationship between sound and design, but very rarely is this the case elsewhere. Although room acoustic science is over a century old, there is still a disjoint between the visual and acoustic quality of many buildings, with the importance of good sound being largely overlooked. We suffer restaurants where you need to shout to be heard, and railway stations where you can barely understand the announcements. Recently, however, a new discipline seems to be emerging, a fusion of acoustics, architecture and psychology, which is looking beyond simple noise reduction. It's about exploring and manipulating the acoustic environment to change the way we feel and even behave. It's called oral architecture.
Oral architecture is all around us. You can't do anything in your life without experiencing it. And there is no such thing as sound without a space.
Barry Blesser is an acoustician, a graduate and former teacher of Boston's Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and the co-author of Spaces Speak, Are You Listening?, a book on oral architecture which attempts to change the way we think about sound.
When you wake up in the morning, you can hear the walls, you can hear the environment. You're not out on the moon, you're not hanging in the air, you're not in the basement, you're not in a cathedral. You hear your space, and the place you are is very important to your emotional stability, whether it's a cathedral or your basement or a bathroom or a classroom or a concert hall. All of these spaces have characteristic signature sounds, but unconsciously they are affecting all aspects of your behavior.
I'm in a big atrium here in the Massachusetts Institute of Technology here in Boston. And in front of me is a wall. I'm not quite sure how far away it is because I've got a blindfold on. And using the acoustics of the space, I'm going to navigate myself, well, to walk towards the wall and not hit it, I hope.
How close am I? I'm actually quite close to it, aren't I? No? Something changed. I'm going to take the blindfold off and see if I succeeded.
Wow, I did it. I can't believe it. I can't believe I actually just did it. I was, 10 centimetres away from the wall when I stopped. I could just suddenly sense it changed. It was suddenly a change in the sound quality, but I was almost unconsciously aware that suddenly there was a wall there.
You were completely unconscious of it in the sense of you're used to thinking about sound sources, but by letting go and relaxing, you could hear the shift, and it just felt like wallness was approaching you, and you actually slowed down considerably before you got to that point, because some part of your brain was saying, I better be careful, there's danger if I keep going.
Barry, you call this auditory spatial awareness. What's going on?
Your brain is picking up the fact that your two ears are detecting the world changing. And from an evolutionary point of view, had this been nightfall and had there been no light, your survival would have depended on hearing the environment. Even though we think of dolphins and bats as navigating a space with their ears, a large number of species, including us, have the latent ability to use it, and we use it unconsciously some of the time.
But we're in a big space here. It's not just the fact we can navigate it using the acoustic. There's also an aesthetic, isn't there,
yes,
quantity?
Absolutely. This space has a unique signature. I went to school here, and we call it the Infinite Corridor, which has a very unique acoustic signature. It can become symbolic. For me, this is a reminder of my period at MIT, you know, 45 years ago. It sticks in my mind like perhaps a flag or a statue. It's a unique sound.
And what emotional impact can this have on us as we go around?
It can have any number of emotional impacts. It can enhance comfort, it can enhance discomfort, it can create arousal, it can create tension, it can create warmth, it can create relaxation. And the place you are is very important to your emotional stability, whether it's a cathedral or your basement or a bathroom or a classroom or a concert hall. All of these spaces have characteristic signature sounds, and you unconsciously rely on that. If I dropped you into a bathroom and said it's a concert hall, you would say, no, it's not, even if you couldn't see it. It just doesn't feel, from an acoustic aural point of view, it doesn't feel like what you want to experience. And it will make you tense if there's too much inconsistency between your expectations and your needs and the reality of where you are.
So aural architecture isn't just about physics, the way sound reflects off the four walls. Is the way it connects sound with meaning, experience, functionality, memory, and emotion. Music critic Richard Dar gives his personal perspective on the sound of the Boston Symphony Hall.
It's an ideal combination of clarity and warmth. That is, you can actually hear everything that's going on, but there's also an aura around it, a fullness. When an orchestra is in sort of full flood, it's an absolutely thrilling experience that isn't like anything else I have ever experienced.
Scientific study has kind of shown that people tend to split between people who like clarity, like to hear very precisely the instruments, and those who like this bloom, this reverberance, this echoiness. Do you know what you prefer?
Well, I prefer a balance between the two. I like to be able to hear anything I want to hear, but I also want to be, you know, in a tidal wave, not a tsunami. So I think the genius of this hall lies in a balance between those two qualities, which are not mutually exclusive, but complementary.
We're in the lobby of the Boston Symphony Hall here. We just heard the first half of a concert. But this is a very interesting acoustic. Why is it so special?
Well, we're out here in the corridor now, and if you can listen carefully, you notice that you can hear me quite clearly, but you're also aware of other conversations taking place. So you have an interesting blend of connecting with me as well as connecting with all the other people here without it being intrusive or overpowering. Because in this space, we have carpets, we have absorptions, we have rugs and chandeliers and tapestries and pictures. You have various blends of connectedness with the reverberation, with the direct sound, and it's the balance. It's like seasoning food. It has to be balanced.
Some of the most exciting sonic spaces predate modern science. Glenn Nickram is president of the Constellation Center, a proposed performing arts venue in Boston. As part of the design work, his team have been gathering acoustic fingerprints from nearly 1,000 buildings around the world, including many of the ancient cathedrals and temples of Europe.
When we would go to these old spaces, frequently we noticed that the acoustical properties not only were good, but the dimensions and the articulations of panels, little mini roofs and things were really like perfect, and began to think this was not an accident, that they actually had seemed to have figured this out. Notre Dame, if you've been to Notre Dame, the Paris version, you know it has a double-sided choir box at the front. Well, originally it had four sides. That is a very specific set of dimensions that creates a very enveloping kind of, almost like you're just buried in sound. And all of those reflections focus the sound on the altar. And we've done this. If you walk up that step, you know, most churches have a step before the altar, you enter a zone of complete surrounding sound of chant, and it's very hypnotic. It's almost like it puts you in this kind of almost religious zone, and it's remarkably powerful, all designed because of these dimensions and the effects, the tilting of the stalls and all kinds of things they put together to create this almost transcendental sound space.
Today, we don't just have precedents to help architects. We also have modern engineering and acousticians to guide the design. Yet many modern buildings still sound terrible. Perhaps part of the problem lies with architects themselves. Barry Blesser's co-author is also his wife, social scientist Dr. Linda Ruth Salter.
I think that architects are not people. I think architects are artists, and they create for themselves. I remember working with some students at MIT a bunch of years ago, and I would say, well, how about considering this functioning aspect and that functioning aspect? And finally the student said, you're getting in my way with all this data, with all these requirements. I'm an artist. I'm creating. And I wanted to say, well, that's great, but what you're creating is very expensive. It's permanent. It's going to be here for 50 or 100 years, and you're going to be processing millions of people. And so all of us who have to live in your space are in your creation. And that's a little unfair. That's a little unreasonable. And they were quite frustrated. So I think part of the problem is with architectural training, that it's one of the fine arts, along with painting and sculpture. And yet with a painting or a sculpture, you can put it in a room and close the door and you don't have to deal with it. But what are you going to do with a multi-million-dollar building that everybody has to be in order to live their lives? We don't have any awards for a well-designed auditory space, well-designed oral architecture. Architects make their fame by designing a building which is a visual icon, which is a visual symbol. And we don't think about ear cons. We don't think about auditory symbols.
Maybe we shouldn't award any architectural prizes until the building's several years old and get the user's input.
That would be a good idea, but then a lot of the people who are most famous today would have to give their prizes back.
Not everyone agrees with this view of architects. Kieran Long, editor of the Architects Journal, believes the overwhelming majority are keenly aware of how their designs work in practice.
I think while there will always be icon mongers in the world, most architects are not there. You know, they don't sit at home wishing they had the opportunity to build a Louvre. They just want to make housing that's pleasant to live in. They want to make public spaces that people want to be in. If you're an Emirati sheikh, you're probably not going to commission Norman Foster to come and make a building that is a foyer for homeless people. You're going to get him to come and make a massive art museum or palace or whatever. And I think, you know, we have to bear in mind the nature of briefs that these big architects get. But in my experience, working with architects every day, I don't know many architects who don't take account very keenly of the human body and its interaction with surfaces and places. But there will always be areas of specialisms where architects haven't had enough education. Acoustics arguably could be one. But I think, you know, there is more now a desire to make intimate places, places where people feel comfortable, than there has been perhaps for a generation in architecture. And eventually people, you would hope, would come around to realising the importance of acoustics in that context.
One person helping to bring acousticians and architects together is Carl Rosenberg. He runs Ascentec, an acoustic consultancy in Boston, but he also teaches architecture students and isn't at all surprised that to most people, architecture is first and foremost a visual medium.
If you look at the way that architecture and design is communicated to the public and to other architects, it's pretty much through magazines, through pictures, through non-experiential media. And I think that's just a function of the way information is conveyed. If we could find a way that people heard spaces and experienced them as part of the review or appreciation of spaces, I think it'd change dramatically. Because I can look at a picture of that's in a published magazine, brand new building, and I look at the activity and I say, this has got to sound terrible. I mean, I can tell that from the way it looks. You see a school with all hard surfaces or a huge volume, or a restaurant with fancy glass ceiling. It's going to sound terrible, but it photographs very well.
Maybe what we need is like one of those birthday cards when you open up, it plays tunes at you. Maybe all architects' journals should open up and play the sound of the space.
I think that's a great idea. We'll get working on that patent right away.
We just walked through your open plan office, and I noticed there was a distinct noise.
Oh, it's not a noise. It's a very pleasant sound, meant to sound like air conditioning. It may not come through on the mic, but it's a very pleasant designed sound spectrum so that it fills in the audio spectrum evenly. There are no tones involved with it. Most people find that it's a very pleasant sound. In some offices where we've had background sound like this introduced electronically, people are not even aware of it. However, if inadvertently it's turned off, sure enough, people think that it's either become too hot in the summer or too cold because of the association of that sound with air conditioning.
It kind of surprises me that you're making noise to make the acoustics better. This seems counterintuitive.
Well, it changes the signal-to-noise ratio. What each of us responds to in an environment is the signal, which could be someone else's distraction. You know, they're talking on the cell phone or who knows what. The relationship between that signal and the background sound is what we hear, what we perceptually respond to. So we can change the signal-to-noise ratio by decreasing the signal or increasing the noise. And it's the two factors together which give us that sense of composure in an office where the signals from a neighbor are no longer as distracting because the background sound level is higher.
I've come to a primary school because they're really interesting acoustic spaces. It's so important to be able to hear the teacher, and it's so important the children aren't too noisy if you actually want to be able to learn. But I haven't come to any old primary school. I've come to the first open-plan school in Britain, which was built back in the 1960s. It's the Evelyn Lowe Primary School in Bermondsey, London. And I actually stood in what looks kind of like a corridor. So what happens when you take the doors off classrooms, when you allow children to walk through your classroom when going from one space to the other? Doesn't it make it an acoustic nightmare?
I'm Maxine Mellett, head of school of Evelyn Lowe Primary School. My previous school was originally was very open planned, and they put doors on the classroom, and it just had totally changed the character of the school. And I guess one of the reasons why I liked this school from when I initially came in here was the openness of it all.
So how does this open plan style fit in with modern curricula, wanting to get people sat at desks and vice versa, very crudely, rote learning? Yeah. How does it fit into the modern style?
Well, I think it fits very well here for the age group. Perhaps that's why we have the self-contained classes for year one when you're having discrete subject areas, but here they're learning through play.
Barry Mason, project manager for the Modernisation Project, and I work for Southwark Council. After the Second World War, there was a consensus that UK education needed a big shake-up for various reasons. 1948 Plowden Report said that open plan schools are the future. Children should be free range, quote, like little chickens running everywhere, out of their cages, out of their little serried ranks. No more rote learning. And this was perhaps the first school, and that's why it got listed as a historic building, the first school that kind of exemplified the Plowden idea of, you know, you shall teach open plan kids in future.
This is the central corridor that is open planned.
I think the interesting thing is the sound quality. Is that what you can hear is you can hear odd snippets of a story to my right. I can hear another classroom with odd scraping of chairs and odd kids making little babbly noises. But none of them are, well, I can hear the words exactly. Mm-hmm. So I can kind of screen that out and still carry on this conversation freely. So I think it's the quality of the sound.
The teachers have to be considerate of each other and actually be careful in their timetabling.
Getting good acoustics in a school is not just about the arrangement of the rooms. It's vital to use materials on the walls, floor and ceiling which absorb sound. Until recently, acoustic engineers could only communicate the importance of sound using numbers, charts and equations. But then a few years ago, technology stepped in. A new tool appeared which let architects hear the buildings they are creating.
So this is the direct sound, and now we're going to add in the reflections from the walls. And now the reflections from the back. And the reflections from the ceiling. And now we'll just add in the general reverberance.
Neil Woodger, a director at Arup Acoustics in London, pioneered the development of SoundLab.
We have a three-dimensional sound system. It's called an ambisonic system. It's a loudspeaker system that allows us to reproduce the sound of the world as we hear it in the real world.
So as you sit in the middle, you've got loudspeakers all around you, on the floor, on the ceiling.
Yes, there's 12 loudspeakers. There's four rows of three at the top, in the middle, at the bottom. And, they reproduce the sound just as we hear it in the real world outside.
So what's the aim of this lab? What do you use it for?
Well, we use this lab with our clients, who are often architects or the clients of buildings, so that they can listen to the design of their building before it's built.
A virtual reality machine for acoustic engineers.
It is a virtual reality machine for acoustic engineers, that's right. In fact, we use some of the software used in virtual reality to help us create these virtual reproductions of the spaces that we're designing. In recent years, they've been able to look at visualizations and computer models of their building, but they've never really had the soundtrack of their building, what their building will sound like and how it'll feel.
Can you take your architect then on a trip around the world acoustically?
That's one of the most exciting things about the Sound Lab. You can jump through space and time to listen to the acoustics of different concert halls in different cities around the world, or you could take them on a tour of, for example, Times Square in New York, or Trafalgar Square in London, or Federation Square in Melbourne. To give them an instant sense of what it's like to be in those different places around the world.
Sound Lab can also help urban planners to reduce noise and compose acoustic oases in the heart of the city. Take this example of a children's playground.
So this is called Burling Slip in New York City. It's just by the FDR, down in the financial area of the city. And currently, it's just used as a car park. If you listen now, there are delivery trucks that are regularly coming in and out. There's a car park. There are buses that travel down at the end of the road, and then you have the elevated highway at the end of the slip. And the great concern about this site in New York was that for a playground, it wouldn't be particularly conducive for children playing here. Well, there was a concern that maybe it wasn't right, or it could be better. So what we wanted to do was look at how the proposed changes to the slip as we introduced the elements of the playground would change the soundscape. So the first thing that happened is we would get rid of the local traffic, because we would effectively pedestrianise the whole area. And then as we introduced the new activities into the space, we get people walking, people talking, we get children playing, we could introduce some trees, and we would start getting maybe the sound of birds in those trees. We have maybe people playing ball games. Maybe we have a little bit of music. Somebody busking on the street corner. Somebody walking their dog. Maybe a little water feature even. And we've actually completely changed the nature of the soundscape.
It sounds to me like what's really important, on top of getting the acoustics right, is the way it changes the relationship between you and the architect and the client, because you can all experience that acoustic and discuss it.
Before we had the Sound Lab, acoustics was like a black art. We had a language that our clients didn't understand. They didn't really necessarily trust what we said either. And therefore, the Sound Lab gives us a common ground where we actually just have to sit them down and we can all listen together and we can come to a consensus decision as to which is the right direction to take the design.
A century after modern science was first applied to Boston Symphony Hall, we now seem to be entering a new phase in architectural acoustics, an age where sound is no longer just seen as an inconvenient functional issue. Maybe if sound is seen as an aesthetic, something that can inspire architects to be creative, we will get great-sounding buildings which also function better. A good example is being constructed right now at Ground Zero. Oral architecture is at the heart of the design for the memorial commemorating the victims of the September 11th attacks. Anne Lewison is designing a museum on the site for architects Snerhetta.
Well, we definitely needed an acoustician for this project, partly because of traffic sound, because of train sound. We're actually on top of two different train stations specifically for our building, and the foundations of our building are adjacent to the subway platforms, which means that whatever sound travels through the columns that support our building is picking up sound from those trains. The other element is that there are two huge fountains, roughly 175 feet long on each leg, 8 legs per fountain, which will have a tremendous amount of noise. In the summertime, when all the trees are filled with leaves because they're all deciduous, I think there will be a very pervasive sound of tree leaves most of the time, and I think that will give it a tremendous amount of calm, that timeless, endless quality, and that will allow you to feel like you've actually left the busy city and are in a place that is solemn and tranquil. It will deaden a lot of the peripheral traffic sounds and city sounds and siren sounds and bus sounds. But the meditative qualities of the site, reflective, the title reflecting absence, I think it will be very clearly articulated in this site.
Christina Flannery, Lucy Fishman. Richard Fitzsimmons, Florida, Lucy Fishman.
The acoustic quality is not always getting equal billing. You can actually have a tremendous effect on how someone feels about something by their own footfall inside it, by the echoes inside it. Everyone loves to go under a bridge in Central Park and make echoes. And yet, we hardly ever allow spaces or design spaces specifically to give you that.
That edition of Discovery was presented by Trevor Cox. The program was produced by Rami Zaba.